Hi, welcome to Art Pod. I'm Kate Wells, and I'm your host of the podcast where we hear from the artists, the thinkers, and the Michiganders that we're following right now. It is still May, I know, but I'm going to go ahead and declare this our first Art Pod of the summer. And in a way, all three of our stories are kind of summery. We're going to have an end of school story, a drinking story. It's no surprise that that comes from Lester Graham. And to wrap things all up, a movie story. So first up, we're going to head over to a school in Metro Detroit, and they're dealing with some pretty heavy stuff. They are essentially taking responsibility for telling the stories of older generations. Here's what I mean. In Metro Detroit's Jewish community, they are trying to keep history alive through music. And this piece of music that you're going to hear involves Anne Frank, her chestnut tree, and a very stressed out high school orchestra. Okay, we have 4 days until showtime, and folks, this Berklee High School Orchestra has gotta pull it together. No pressure, but they are about to perform the American premiere of a famous German composer's original cantata about the Holocaust. And before you know it, this concert hall is going to be packed with rabbis, Holocaust survivors. Even the German composer himself is flying all the way in just to see this. So you can understand why the violinists are stressing.
It was really bad.
Yeah, it was not as good as we could have played it. Yeah.
I mean, that's just the honesty.
The percussionists are like, what do you mean? It's going great.
This is the first time it sounded like music.
To understand why this is happening, we actually have to go all the way back to Anne Frank and a tree. Specifically, the chestnut tree that stood outside her attic window where she and her family hid from the Nazis. I don't know if you remember in her diary, but it's basically the only thing of the outside world that she can see, and it represents hope and resilience. And when the tree died recently, 11 saplings were saved, and you can bet that there was a massive competition for each and every one of them. Michigan's Holocaust Memorial Museum snagged one. Stephen Goldman is their executive director.
The Holocaust Memorial Center was one of the sites that was granted a tree, along with places like the 9/11 Memorial, the Clinton Library, the White House.
So obviously the museum wants a big, splashy way to celebrate having the sapling. So they've worked a lot with the Berklee High School. They are a really good orchestra. They've got a lot of Jewish kids. And that's how they ended up performing the American premiere of this German cantata entitled My Name is Anne Frank. This piece is complicated. The rhythms are weird. It's difficult to play. There's not a whole lot of melody. But some of the kids are really into it. Isabel Robleski sings in the choir, and she says this piece actually makes her feel like she is with Anne Frank.
I love this piece of music. As
you don't have to play the violin.
Horrible yeah. as it may be, the sounds that we make and the emotions that we try to convey to the audience are extremely powerful.
In Hebrew school, we've always learned, if you forget the Holocaust, it'll happen again.
This is Austin Glass. He is one of the much-put-upon violinists.
You know, if we don't let Holocaust survivors tell their story, then we haven't learned anything about the horrors. So this is really what we work on, not necessarily just getting every note perfect, but really conveying the emotion.
And then it's showtime. And you know what? It really does all come together. Seriously, not just because that's a great ending for this story, but somehow the full thing with the lyrics layered on top of this dark, unsettling music, it just works. After all the applause, violinist Austin Glass says that this kind of all hit him just as they were about to play.
I didn't know that there were going to be Holocaust survivors in the audience, and that put, I think it put a lot more pressure on it, but it made it a lot more real for us.
One of those survivors is Guy Stern. He says watching these kids play is so satisfying.
Because it's my voice instilled in them and coming out of there. To hear that wonderful dedication of those children, because you felt that they felt. And that's a great thing.
He says it also makes him hopeful. Because as his generation is dying out, the last of the survivors, their stories are living on. All right, next, we are going to take a moment. We're going to shift gears. We're going to lighten things up. We sent Lester Graham out on a very difficult assignment. He had to drink his way around Michigan and essentially tell us how that went. But in all seriousness, Lester went out to figure out what is going on in Michigan's craft cocktail scene, and I'm going to let him take it from here.
I'm Lester Graham with Michigan Radio. If you think about states known for distilled spirits such as bourbon and whiskey, you might think about Kentucky or Tennessee. But Michigan is becoming home to its own distilleries. It's being driven in part by a growing interest in craft cocktails. The first thing you're likely to notice in these craft cocktail bars is all the fruit and jars of herbs such as mint and rosemary. You're not going to find pre-mixed bottles of corn syrup-laden sweet and sour here. It's all about real aromas and flavors. Right now, there are a half dozen or so craft cocktail bars, mostly in southeastern Michigan. One of them is The Last Word, where we talk with manager Robin Schultz. He says they're always looking for new spirits to give their drinks some more depth, more interest. And some of them are being made here in Michigan.
We have the Knickerbocker from New Holland. Journeyman Distillery just opened up recently. We have their gin. We also have stuff out of the distillery in Ferndale now. So we are trying to bring in a lot of the Michigan products that are coming out of the market.
That fits for these speakeasy-like cocktail bars looking for variety. Since Prohibition, most liquor has kind of been the same. Tammy Coxon is with Tammy's Tastings. She teaches cocktail classes in Ann Arbor.
Before Prohibition, there were hundreds of distillers all making unique products. And after Prohibition and what that did to the distilling industry in the U.S., all that production has been concentrated in a very small number of distillers who are making basically variations on the same thing.
And with the cocktail movement growing and taste changing,
people have started to embrace those more assertive flavors that aren't just candy covering up alcohol. And really want to appreciate the craft of fine distilling and fine cocktails.
For people who are tired of cotton candy-flavored vodka and the bartenders who are becoming artisans of their craft, that's some good news. And a major university here in Michigan is helping. The Artisan Distilled Program Research Facility is a public-private operation run by Michigan State University. Chris Berglund started this as a one-still operation making brandy 17 years ago, and now it's a state-of-the-art research facility.
We're the only university in the United States that has access to a commercial license.
Which means not just research, it can produce distilled spirits.
So we do a lot of work with people when they're developing their products long before they have their licenses. So we work with a lot of startups like that.
Which is great for distillers like J.P. Jerome. He's with the Detroit City Distillery, which will be opening at the Eastern Market in early 2014. But they're making Michigan whiskey right now.
We're just about to put it in these barrels. And the wheat and the barley we got direct from a local farmer. And so we're trying to go very local with our ingredients and go farm to bottle.
Jerome says this program and its experts are a huge advantage for distillers. Ari Sussman at the MSU Distillery used to be a bartender involved in this craft cocktail movement.
I actually spent a long time looking in culinary historical libraries like the Clements Library in Ann Arbor and reading about spirits that no longer exist. And as a bartender, that's frustrating. So I figured the best way of making these spirits available would be to make them.
Back at The Last Word, Robin Schultz says it's been great for this new cocktail renaissance.
For a bartender to see all these distilleries opening up, it's really exciting because there's going to be a lot of new ideas, a lot of new flavors to the market. And then as a bartender, then we get to be creative and try and mix a drink with that.
And I don't know about you, but that's something I can toast.
To new spirits in Michigan.
Absolutely.
Cheers.
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 With Michigan Radio News, I'm Lester Graham.
By the way, the MSU Artisan Distilled Program Research Facility is opening a tasting room this summer. It's called Red Cedar Spirits. It'll serve spirits and educate the public about the developing industry.
And finally, before we go, you may have heard about a documentary that previewed in Michigan earlier this month. It was called Soul Survivor. There was a lot of buzz about it. There was an article in just about all the papers, online websites. But of course, the tickets were sold out really fast for this, and there were only two previews. So chances are you may not have been able to make it in, but we went, and we want to talk to you a little bit more about some of the depth and the story and the people behind this documentary. Now, in case you didn't hear, a quick refresher. About 26 years ago, there was a big plane crash outside Detroit Metro Airport. Northwest Flight 255 went down on the freeway. 156 people were killed. It's one of the worst crashes in aviation history. But there was one little girl who survived. She was the only survivor. Her name is Cecilia Sheehan. And in this documentary, for the very first time, she speaks publicly about her experience and where she is now. And for family members of the people who died on that flight, Flight 255, this is an incredibly meaningful experience to hear from this little girl, all grown up, for the very first time. This lying outside the movie theater where the documentary Soul Survivor is about to be screened for the first time, everybody is a little quiet, a little tense, which is understandable. Most of these people are probably family members of somebody who died on Flight 255. One of the chatters, though, is Shirley Friedman. She comes up to me out of the blue and says, I want to show you a photo of my granddaughter.
Joanne was in the crash. This is when she graduated high school.
What do you think about seeing Cecilia speak about this for the first time? What are you hoping to see?
I was so surprised and shocked. I'll tell you the truth, I didn't know what to think. Everybody told me, come today, because it was very touching to know that somebody survived. I wished more of them had.
The director of this documentary is also here. Her name is Kai Dickens. She says ever since people started hearing that she had actually gotten an interview with Cecilia Sheehan, the sole survivor of that flight, Dickens says she got the same email and phone call over and over and over. How is Cecilia? Is she happy? Will you tell her that we think about her?
Her living keeps their loved one living on. She's the last connection to them. And I hope that when people see the survivors, there is an element of healing that can come with it.
And then the film is starting. And when Sheehan's face fills that big movie theater screen, she just sounds good. She's this blonde, poised young woman.
I'm happily married to my high school sweetheart. I'm studying to get my master's in art therapy. I am happy. I've never been happier.
And then she looks right at camera and she says, I know I don't talk or see you guys, but I feel like a member of the Flight 255 family.
I do think about you guys and what you must have gone through.
Before the movie ends, there's this other scene in front of the Flight 255 memorial plaque. And this woman is talking about the family that she lost in the crash and how she bumped into Cecilia Sheehan by total accident one day.
I cried like a little baby because to me, there was a part of this whole episode that was missing, is her. And it was like when I met her, it put that little piece of the puzzle in place.
When the movie ends and the lights come up, I bump into Shirley Friedman, the woman who lost her granddaughter, Joanne. She says that seeing Sheehan brought everything back.
How sad it was that how these people are gone. People that should really still be here. But what could you do? You only can make the best of it.
There is actually one person who has been in touch with Sheehan all of these years. His name is John Theed, and he is the firefighter who carried little Cecilia Sheehan from the wreckage. They talk regularly, they text message, they even danced at her wedding. And Theed says now that everybody can hear from Sheehan themselves, there might be a little bit more peace.
I think there's still a healing process with the people, you know, the families. And finally, after being gone so long and nobody knowing what happened to her, you know, I think family members kind of, you know, I think has the closure to it.
The film Soul Survivor opens in wide release later this year. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News. Okay, that is all we've got for you this time around. We want to make sure we hear what's going on in your neck of the woods. This is where we get some of our most amazing, incredible, needle-in-the-haystack stories. Tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods in terms of artists, music, anything that you think everybody else in the rest of the state would be really interested to know is going on in your neighborhood. So go ahead, leave us comments below. Hey, even leave your own craft cocktail recipe for Lester. He made up a recipe of his own at michiganradio.org, so go ahead, check it out. For now, that's all we got. I'm Kate Wells. Thanks for listening from Michigan Radio News.